Vibrant
music teaching.
Proven and practical
tips, strategies,
and ideas
for music teachers.
This is the Vibrant Music Teaching Podcast. I'm Nicola Canton, and today we're talking about the 11 laws of piano practice for kids. The book is called Superpowered Practice, and it's designed as a guide to practice that's hopefully fun and readable for middle grade readers and above, although definitely it could be read by a parent and kiddo who's at a younger reading age than that. So I hope you'll check out the book Superpowered Practice, but what I want to do here is have the grown-up version of the conversation of what is covered in this book. So you can see, maybe if you agree with me, maybe we can open up some chat about this and continue it in the comments, and we can unpack some of the details in a different way than I've covered them in the book. So just to give you a sense of where this is coming from, in the book, it's divided into two kind of distinct parts. The second part is much shorter, and that's around specific practice strategies that are very adaptable and any kid can use. And that's in the back of the book, sort of like a cheat code to practice strategies. But most of the book is part one. In that section, I go through 11 laws of practice, is what I've called them. And each one starts with a story. So it's like part novel, part lecture series in a kid-friendly format. So each chapter starts with the story, which continues throughout the book. It's one big long story. And then we take a lesson from that and take out the law of practice and explain that a bit further. So it's kind of approaching it from a fiction and non-fiction standpoint in each chapter to hopefully get the point across in a way that's engaging for most kids of this age, depending on how they like to think about things. Hopefully they'll read both sections. Even if they just enjoy the story, they'll still get some of the information from that. Or if they prefer the more factual approach, they could ignore the story if they like and just focus on the second half of each chapter. But I hope they'll read them mostly together because they really work in conjunction to make it not just a lecture about how you should practice, but something that's really engaging and fun. So again, the book is called Superpowered Practice, and it's for kids, but you can read it too. However, here we're going to talk about those 11 laws of practice and unpack each one a little bit so I can explain where I'm coming from and why it was important for it to make that list. There's so many different ideas about practice and facts and interesting points that I could have gone into, and I really tried to narrow it down and landed on these 11 as being, if I could get kids to believe all these 11 things, they would be so far ahead of the average student in piano, but also in learning things in general in life. The first law of piano practice that I've included in the book is practice is difficult. Oh my gosh, how controversial. How dare I say that? Why am I starting off by turning people off from practice? Well, here's the thing. I think a lot of the time, with the best of intentions, we can gloss over the fact that things are difficult, and we end up negating a student's experience and or letting them believe that it's only difficult for them because we don't think that it should be difficult, right? We're communicating, no, it's easy, no, it's no problem, no, you can do it. But because of the way we're phrasing that and the fact that they internally are finding it really tough, we end up saying, it's only difficult for you. That's the subtext they sometimes feel, even if they couldn't articulate it that way. Then they come to believe, well, I'm just stupid. I don't get it. I'm not skilled enough. Something about them is true. And it talks them into a fixed mindset. So that's why I wanted to start right away with practice is difficult. Because the truth is, it is difficult to practice. It is both difficult to consistently find the time to practice, more than ever in today's world, but it's always been difficult. It is difficult to push yourself to try new things. But even more than that, if it is not difficult, it is not practice. And I don't mean that it means feels impossibly hard or unpleasant, but it should feel on some level challenging. Otherwise, you're not practicing. You're playing. You're just, messing around. And all of those things are fine. But if we want to practice, we are intentionally working towards a goal. We're trying to get better at something. And so if it doesn't feel in any way challenging, difficult, or hard, then we're not practicing. And that's why I decided to start with that as my number one law. Practice is difficult. Because if it's not difficult, it's not practice. Law number two. You get what you repeat. This is a big one that I didn't get, that students didn't get, and I've talked about this before, until far too far into my teaching. It's one of those things that we feel like it's common sense because of our background, and some students do just immediately get this and it's common sense to them. Some parents, it's common sense to them, so they're reinforcing that, but some people don't know it. And they need the information. They need to understand that they need to repeat stuff, number one. So it doesn't really work if we just play things once. It kind of works at the very start because we're not giving students things that are that challenging and we want them to have quick wins. And therefore, at the beginning, yeah, if they play everything once every day, they'll probably get away with it. Get away with it, quote unquote, right? But as they go forward, they have to learn to repeat stuff. Because without repetition, you don't get anywhere. And I don't mean mindless repetition. I don't mean to condone just like spending way too much time going over and over and over in something and sort of battering it into your hands. But again, I think this is where we get a bit skewed. Because of our backgrounds, because many of us may have been to music college and been in a competitive environment, we're more likely to be rallying against that in our mind because people took it to the extreme in the opposite direction. But I think the general population needs to be encouraged to repeat more because they're not doing it enough and they're not getting that point. And that's the experience I've had as a teacher, is that students really have to be trained to repeat stuff at all. And they need to get that idea in their head before we can make it refined and make it better. So that's why this is law number two. These are not exactly in order of importance, but I did want it to be that if a student gave up reading this book after a couple of chapters, they would get the most important stuff. This is one of the most important things, is repetition. Now, notice the way I phrased it. You get what you repeat. So I have hinted at and explained a bit more in the book that it's not actually, okay, just repeat stuff. I'm not saying that. You get what you repeat. So if you repeat it wrong a whole bunch of times, tough luck, you're going to play it wrong next time. Your brain doesn't take in, like the muscle memory doesn't take in, yeah, she did it a whole bunch of times, but every time she told me, she didn't really mean that. Every time she told me, no, it actually is F natural, even though she played F sharp. That's not how it works. When we play in future, yes, it's not an exact one-to-one, but we do generally get what we repeated. The product is roughly the sum of all of our repetitions averaged out. And that's the point I try to get across to kids in that chapter. Law number three. You ready for this one? Law number three is you did play it better at home. You did. That's the truth. I know many of us teachers have heard, oh, but I played it better at home, or it didn't go like this before, or I'm not happy with that, I never played that well here. Some variation of this, right? And the truth is they probably did. But also, there's a caveat to that, right? There's a dot, dot, dot there. Yes, you probably played it better at home because you are more comfortable, you're on your own piano, or you were in your own space. You probably did play better. But also, you probably remember the last repetition the most. This is the thing that I think sometimes gets missed in this conversation. We tell students, yeah, I know you did play better at home because, you know, it was your own piano, blah, blah, blah. We often do that first part, but we miss the second part, which is you probably played it only a little bit better at home if we average it out, because students often repeat things a lot of time. Great. We've already talked about that. That's great. So they repeat things, and then in their brain, they remember the last time they did it, basically. And then when they sit down in their piano lesson, they expect the last time to be what comes out of their fingers. but it's not going to. It's going to be a rough average because you get what you repeat. So I think those two things interplay with each other, and that's why I kind of, yes, I give them the grace. You probably did play better at home. I believe you. But I also think there are other factors there making you believe that it was even shinier than it was at home. Rule number four is the importance of almost forgetting. What? The importance of almost forgetting is my kid-friendly way of kind of explaining interleave practice, spaced repetition practice, all of these concepts that we've come to know in the piano teaching world as being really effective practice strategies. Now, we're not going all the way to that in this book because it's a middle grade book. I'm not expecting practice perfection, but I want to lay some of the foundations. And in the importance of almost forgetting, that's what we're talking about, is you forget something a little bit, you call it back, and so your forgetting is slower the next time, is essentially how I explain that in the book. Each time you call it back, you forget a little bit less the next time. So just playing back-to-back repetitions is not the be-all and end-all, because you need to allow some time to forget a little bit and then remember again. This reminds me of a story a teacher friend of mine told me about a student they had who had a lot on, right? She had a lot on, and she had a lot of different projects, very ambitious in her piano studies, but also had a lot of other hobbies, right? And she was saying every time in her lesson, she was saying, I'm practicing every day to this teacher, but I'm not getting better. I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. And initially, maybe the teacher's thinking, are you really practicing every day? But she insisted she was, and she seemed like a very honest kiddo. And her parent was saying, yeah, she's going to the piano every day. So they started to talk about what she was really doing in her practice time. And lo and behold, she was dividing up her assignments between the different days of the week. So let's say she had an E major scale and then three different pieces. She was doing the E major scale on Monday, and then piece A on Tuesday, and then piece B on Wednesday. That's how she was getting through everything, because she didn't have time, she thought, to practice all the things. The issue with that is it's too much time. It's too much forgetting time for each individual thing. So the importance of almost forgetting is about that. It's about you need to allow enough time to forget it, and then you need to recall it. And you need to repeat that over and over so that it will stick. Law number five is a big one for any teacher. It's a big frustration. I put it right in the middle. Law number five is slow is fast. Now, if there's one that I think, despite my best argument, students will still ignore, it is this one. I'm not attempting to tell you that if your students read this book, or you read it to them, that magically they will practice slowly forevermore as you've told them to 1,000 times before. But one more argument can't hurt, right? So this law is about the fact that going slow actually gets you faster results in many cases. There's room for fast practice too. There's room for those students who need to be pushed to go faster because their default is snail. But I think we have more students who are the other way. We have more speed demons, right? So this is very simple. It doesn't take a huge amount of explaining. You know why this is important. But in this law and in this chapter, I attempt to make the argument that going slower will get them there faster. Law number six is a curious one. Literally. I've called it curiosity saved the cat. So up until this point, I've been like, be methodical. Repeat stuff enough times. Go slower, right? That's the gist of what we've been saying. Practice is hard. You need to work hard. Now let's take a step back and say, okay, we're working hard. We are going to make better progress from this point on, if we're building these laws up, if we inject curiosity into what's happening. Repeating things a bunch of times in the same exact way is a recipe for your brain leaving the building, right? It's a recipe for your student's brain to just float off into the ether and start thinking about pizza. So this is where we talk about curiosity and creativity and bringing those things into practice. We need to be asking questions. We need to be thinking, what if? What if it was like this or like that? What if I tried it this way or that way? And that's where we can start to bring the magic back into practice and get them to think more interestingly about how they're spending their practice. And this is part of how we keep the practice going long term, right? I talk about building a practice routine in the beginning, building repetition after that. Those things are great for the first year to 2 years, even. Of course, if we get to this point faster, that's great. But after that is where we can have this series sudden drop off, and suddenly a kid doesn't want to practice anymore and becomes a fight at home where it never was one. And that's because they've just gotten kind of complacent, bored, and they're just doing the same thing over and over. So we need to build in that curiosity that they can maintain that focus and that practice habit for the long term. Rule number 7 is definitely related to that. They're almost two sides of the same argument. Not opposing sides, like two arguments in the same direction. Rule number 7 is make it harder on purpose. This is the concept I call desirable difficulty. So making things more difficult on purpose. And really this has the same reasoning as curiosity. It's just a different way of approaching it, and both are valid and both will help students at different times. But the reasoning is simple. It's we need to keep the brain working. We need to keep the brain in the room, in the present, in mindfulness, right? If everything feels easy, if everything feels not that hard, we've gone back into, okay, we're not really practicing, right? So that's where we need to make things harder on purpose. And that's not for the beginning of practice. Most of the time, just playing a simple piece from start to finish is hard enough for a beginner. But as things go on, we need to inject those desirable difficulties into the practice so that students stay present, stay awake, keep their brain engaged, and so that when you've made it harder on purpose and you go back to what you're actually trying to achieve, like that you already made harder, you're now coming back to normal version of that thing, scale, section of a piece, fingering, whatever. Now it feels easier than it did before. Law number 8, I've simply called thinking time. I actually explain this in the book. I explain that some students spend too much time thinking and not enough time doing. But mostly that's adults. Adult students are the worst for this, and they need to learn to have less thinking time. It's a general rule, you'll have exceptions, but most adults spend too much time thinking and talking about the thing and not enough time just doing it. And trying to do it and falling on their face and picking themselves up and doing it again. Kids' default, more often than not, is fall on my face repeatedly without pausing to think, hey, why did I fall on my face? Was there a stone in my path that made me trip up, right? So not every kid, not every adult, but in general, they fall into those buckets. That's why law number 8 really just talks about injecting a second, even, of pause, like building a little routine of taking their hands off the piano after they've tried to do something, putting them in the lap and taking a deep breath. Simple things like that. They inject some time, and at first it'll just be forced time that they're not really thinking about it, but if that time exists, they will then be able to think during that time. And that's when they can start asking themselves questions and becoming a much more sophisticated practicer. Because a really good musician is going to be stopping and thinking, how did I intend that to sound? And how did it really sound? How can I make the difference between those happen? What did I intend to do there? But what did I actually do? And how can I bridge that gap? But it starts with the time for those thoughts. And that's what that chapter is all about. Law number 9, I've called before and after matter. This is one of my favorite chapters to write the fiction section for. And to give you a little glimpse into that, that was set around the child in the story is playing a computer game and then doesn't want to practice. That's the gist of it. Try not to make it too anti video game or computer game, even though basically I am that. I hope I've walked that line correctly. I know some people absolutely love games. It's not my thing at all. So it's just a little glimpse into that, but it is a highly stimulating activity because the kid is younger, or the imagined kid who doesn't have a specific age in the book is supposed to be sort of younger. I'm stuck with a video game, but I think the lesson there holds true for teenagers who are stuck on social media and then trying to practice and all these different scenarios, right? That's the framework in the fiction section. What I'm talking about here is considering what's around your practice, because a lot of parents and students don't think about this. They think about making the time to practice, and then they say, oh, they hate practicing, they hate it, we always have a fight about it. And then you unpack it, and the thing that comes just before it is the reason that they hate it. Because that thing, and it could be for many reasons. The video game example is they're amped up, they're in this specific mindset, they've got all these chemicals rushing around their brain, all of that stuff is going on, and they're not in a place to sit down and focus on this slower, analog thing. However, it could also be it's straight after school, they're exhausted. It could be they just did physical activity and they haven't had enough water. I mean, it can be very simple things. But considering what state are we in before practice? And if we can't change where that's happening in our schedule, like that might not be realistic. What's a transition thing that we could do? What's a little routine we could have so that by the time we get to the practice, we're in a better state of mind to actually participate in that thing and enjoy it? Law number 10, I've called hands-on keys. I don't say specifically in the book, but this is inspired by my friend Christina Whitlock. Hands-on keys, I think, is a phrase she may have gotten from another teacher. So credit upon credit upon credit for the chain of the community of teachers who share their wisdom. But this is such a simple concept, and I think it's underrated. You know, the whole Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours thing, which I don't think he loves being quoted on anymore, is out there, but I don't think people really take it in. Not the 10,000 hours. They love that number. They take that in. But I don't think they really take in, you just have to spend time doing the thing. You actually have to invest that quality of time and quantity of time into trying to do the thing. You have to have your hands on the keys. Enough. There's no negotiating that. For adult students, there's no thinking and talking your way out of that. You have to do it. You have to spend time with it. And that's what that whole chapter is about. My final law then, I left for last on purpose, not because it's least important, actually one of the most important. My final law I simply called compare with yourself, appreciate others. Comparing with yourself could be a whole other perfectionist can of worms, but the lesson I'm trying to get across in this chapter, it's not a competition. We're here to share music. The example in the story section of that chapter is that the kid in the story feels really good about their performance. They've performed in a concert at their school, and then another kid plays something, and they feel like, oh, they're so much better than me. So we feel good about the music we've shared, and then someone shares something else, and we feel less good about our own music. It didn't change our own music. This law, left it for last because it is a bigger message maybe than just practice, but also because it may take a bit to sink in and it may be over some students' heads, and that's okay. But I wanted to start that conversation because it's all just music you're sharing. Who cares if you're more beginner than them or your piece is not as virtuosic or whatever? You shared music with an audience, or you shared music with yourself in your own home. How is someone making a video of a fancier piece or playing your piece differently detracting from your music? They are not. So yes, it's a big lesson, but I believe in kids. I believe they can take these things in. Sometimes we shy away from these bigger topics with this age group, but actually they're primed to receive this stuff if it's approached in the right way. And it can at least start the thought process in their brain that maybe comes up later. Maybe they don't agree with me right away. Maybe they think I'm full of nonsense. And maybe other things in their life are causing them to feel that, no, it is a competition. Everything is. Maybe they have those kinds of influences going on. But I hope to at least put a nugget in their brain that says, this is not about you versus them. It's about everyone doing something they love, whether that's music or anything else, and sharing it and being in community through that. So those are my 11 laws of practice from the book. Again, my new book is called Superpowered Practice. I hope you'll check it out. I hope you'll maybe buy it for a student or share it with parents in your studio or read it together as a sort of studio project. There are also little discussion questions included at the end of each chapter to encourage parents or teachers to talk about this stuff with the kiddos who are reading the book. Vibrant Music Teaching Membership costs less than the price of one lesson each month. That is totally worth it for all of the courses, games, resources, downloadables, printables that you can get access to as a member, as well as a fabulous community support you'll find inside. Go to vmt.ninja and become part of the revolution.